Should you order genetic tests off the internet? What about using a ketogenic diet for weight loss? Welcome to the Inside Sport Nutrition Podcast, your source for all things sport nutrition related. This show is hosted by myself, Bob Sibahar, and my awesome co-host, Dina Griffin. We are both registered dietitians who specialize in sport nutrition, and combined, we have an experience level of over 40 years. We are here to help provide translation of science to real life and really bring nutrition out into real life and help you just dissect what's going on out there. So every week, we're going to give you some great interviews with people. Dean and I are going to chat a little bit about various sport nutrition topics. And, you know, we just want to bring a great conversation to you each week. So today's episode, as I alluded to a little bit in the intro, we talk to Amanda Archbold, who is a registered dietitian and founder of the Genomic Kitchen. Now, we had her on previously, and we talked about this whole genomics concept. Now, what we're going to discuss on this episode is we're going to break down nutrigenetics and nutrigenomics and those differences. We're going to discuss how these genetic tests off the internet could possibly not be the greatest thing, depending on which ones you choose and who's interpreting the data. We're also going to chat about certain genes that influence appetite control and why you may feel constantly hungry or a little bit of loss of control in certain food environments. We're going to discuss using a ketogenic diet for weight loss and dietary recommendations that aren't considering the genetic picture, because where we're going these days with nutrition in terms of kind of specializing and customizing to every person is bringing the genetics and genomics into the limelight, because there's so much to learn. And sometimes, based on our genetics, it does require some different feeding strategies. So we're super excited for this episode. We're also going to chat a little bit in the episode with olive oil, because olive oil, as we've all heard, olive oil is great, but we're really going to talk about the concept of why it's so great. So a little bit more really quickly about Amanda. She is the founder of the Genomic Kitchen. She is widely recognized for her trailblazing work as a clinician, educator, consultant, speaker, and mentor in the cutting-edge world of genomic medicine. She masterfully connects the dots between genes, food, lifestyle, and health restoration. In addition to working with a global clientele in private practice, she also trains the next generation of healthcare providers in the art and science of using genomics as a foundational tool in medical and clinical practice. She has been pioneering work all around the world in the US, Europe, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand. We are just so, so happy to have Amanda back on. You have to check out her book, The Genomic Kitchen. It is an amazing book. And it's not just a high level, like, oh my gosh, I'm not going to understand this book, right? There's a lot of great information in there in terms of what you can do from a genomic and food perspective right now. Like, go to the store, choose some different foods, put them together, right? So you're going to love this episode. Really quick before we get to it, this episode is sponsored by my All Around Snack Co. company. I have created metabolically efficient, tasty snacks without preservatives or additives or dyes or any of that stuff, right? Getting some great snacks. I've got protein puffs, snack mix, energy bites, and my newest energy butter. All of it stabilizes blood sugar, controls energy level throughout the day with some very solid ingredients. If you go to the All Around Snack Co. website, allaroundsnackco.com, use the code ISNPODCAST23. It'll get you 15% off, and I super appreciate your support. Now, on to our episode. Oh my gosh, Dina, are you as excited as I am this morning for the chat we're going to have with our very special friend and guest, Amanda Archbold?
Yes, she is always extreme wealth of information and continual learning from this amazing leader in the field of nutrigenetics, nutrigenomics. Welcome, Amanda Archbold. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's good to be back with my Colorado pals.
That's right.
We shake hands on the side of the Rockies, right?
That's true. You see the Colorado Monument. We see this side of the Rockies.
That's right.
I love it. Hey, Dina, are your palms sweaty?
A little.
little bit. Yeah. You know, how, like, that's when you know it's, we have a great guest, because when Dina's palms start sweating and she kind of gets a little edgy, we know we've got an awesome guest. So Amanda, thank you so much. It's been a while, right? You are on our episode 7 of our podcast. So we just want to thank you for being back. And this time around, we're not going to cover the basics of genomics and nutrigenomics and nutrigenetics. We are going to have you kind of do a little primer for those listeners who may have not listened to our episode 7. But to start out with, you know, Amanda, you travel so much, and I love following you on Facebook and social media because I love the photos and I love what you're doing. Can you just kind of give us an idea? What was your most recent trip and what excited you about that trip?
You know, actually what's excited me, you'll be amused, is I actually haven't gone very far from home recently. Yeah, honestly, I've stayed on the Western Slope, which is the western side of Colorado, for those of you who don't know Colorado. In my backyard is like canyons, you know, rivers, canyons, if you will. So I've actually stayed a lot closer to home. And I honestly think my last trip was probably skiing in Telluride.
Wow.
You know,
in this all right. Season.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So I haven't been too far, but I am heading to Australia at the end of this year too.
I actually saw that. I saw that post. Yeah. Well, obviously, you know, when I feel like we're all blessed when you live in a state like Colorado, sometimes you don't have to go too far to really enjoy the things that you love enjoying. And that's usually why we're here, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, catch us up. So there are some listeners who haven't tuned in before, and they're like, nutrigenomics, nutrigenetics, what are they talking about? Can you just give us a quick primer again? Like, what is this? What are we talking about? And maybe why it's important? Because you are, listeners, listen, Amanda is the foremost expert. She literally, I'm just going to go out and say this, Amanda, you put this on the map, right? I mean, you can say different, but you did put this on the map and we appreciate it. But tell our listeners, you know, what it is, what's going on with it, and what the heck, why do we need to know about this?
Yeah, why do we need to know about it? So all three of us have worked for many, many years in the nutrition science space, right? And it's been a long slog in the space. And the reason I say that is genetics is the map of how you're built. Or when we're looking at DNA information, it is a heat map for you. I love that idea. It's a heat map. And the reason I say heat map is we're all born with the same genes. It's just little nuances in your genes can change how you respond to exercise, how you respond to diet, how well you sleep, et cetera, whether you have a predisposition to potentially higher blood sugar than somebody else in your family. So genomics allows us to see you through your DNA, which gives us a brilliant starting point when we're trying to figure out what's wrong, what are your metabolic efficiencies and inefficiencies, and what can we do about that? So what I just explained is really nutrigenetics, how your genes influence how you operate in this world. Nutrigenomics is what we're going to do about it by plugging in very specific foods or information from foods to steer your red, the heat in your map back to green. How does that sound? So
I love that. I love that. We should circle in the whole, because I'm sure listeners heard this and they're confused because they're like, information in food, what? So let's push the pause button on that and let's circle that back, because yes, listeners, there is information in the food. It's not just about eating a certain food and feeling full or feeling hungry or whatever. Like, there are so many other things, and that's why we love talking to you, Amanda.
So the information food, so oftentimes we think of information, what you see on a label, right? Which is often is your macros, your percentages of protein and fat and carbohydrate. And some of the most useful information is not actually on a label, right? That we really would like to see. So information in food is caloric. It's your macros, like I just said. It's also minerals, vitamins and minerals. But what we learned probably in the beginning of the 90s is there is even more information in food called phytochemicals. You might know that as phytonutrients or bioactives. And these molecules in food act like triggers or signals to turn on and off genes. So it's like having something in your back pocket that says, you know what, if this gene is struggling, it needs information from food. It can need a certain type of fat. It definitely needs your vitamins and minerals. But we can trigger genes on and off by using these phytochemicals. So an example might be quercetin or quercetin, which you find in capers, is found in all your, you know, radishes, apples, all your alliums, so your chives, garlic, or whatever. We can use this bioactive to steer kind of information around your body, or to light up pathways or shut down pathways. That's what's powerful about this. And we also know that we can use this kind of information to turn on and off genes when we're looking at something like cancer as well. So we can't run too far with that. But as we're looking at research, we know how to inhibit and activate processes. And that's what's really, really important. And it's sort of like pharmaceuticals through the nutrition lens, right? It's a similar idea.
That's great. Amanda, I wanted to just add on here with you, or have you teach this to the listeners too, something here more in the like setting the stage realm before we go into some more specific topics, but something that you teach repeatedly that's such an important message I think is missed is when we look at genetic testing or nutrigenetic testing, is the importance of it being a roadmap, like you said, or a heat map, but that big picture needs to be considered, and also what the individual is looking for, or what their concerns are, or their complaints, because so many look at single genes to maybe provide this nutrition guidance. And so I wonder if you could just expand on that a little bit.
So you're talking monogenic versus polygenic, is that? So it's a really, really good point in that, because I teach clinicians around the world too. So not only am I seeing, you know, individuals who are listening in, but I'm also teaching clinically, which is important. And what we don't want to do is what I call line item nutrition. In other words, we do not read genetics as you've got this gene, therefore do that. It's not plug and play. And that's the intricacy of the field. It's that we are trained to look at how genes operate in a pathway. So it's never one gene. So those of you who say I've got MTHFR, we all do. Okay. And it's probably one of the biggest hiccups. Everyone has MTHFR. In fact, we have several versions of this gene. So we never look at genetic report and say, oh, you've got this version of MTHFR, therefore you need this supplement. What we look at is exactly what you, Dina, you said. What is the individual? What is the ask? What is somebody coming to see me for? What are your issues? What are you trying to achieve? Because then we can look at gene patterns in multiple genes in a pathway to put together, if you will, a plan to steer those genes to kind of set you back on your course, if you will. So line item nutrition, if you ever order a DNA test or the internet or whatever, and it says, oh, you've got this gene, you need this supplement, or you need this specific food, I caution you, because we never look at genes in isolation, ever.
Thank you.
Such a great message. And unfortunately, I think a lot of consumers do that only because the companies that they may choose for the testing may direct them that way, or maybe their summaries are saying that, who knows. You don't have to answer this specifically, Amanda, unless you'd like to, but are there, you know, regarding testing, as you know, we love testing, like test, don't guess, but for a purpose, like be able to use that testing. Are there companies out there that we can recommend our listeners, I don't want to say trust, but maybe put more worth into spending their hard-earned money? Like, can you go out and tell us companies? Is that safe now? Or
I mean, I can tell you which companies I work with. But what I would say is genetics, the work we do is very complex, even in our minds, you know, clinic. I would say to anyone, do not order a test directly yourself to solve complex health issues. Please see a clinician who's trained in genetics, because most of the tests we use are not available for you to order directly. They're just not. And if you do order directly and the company says, hey, you can talk with one of our specialists or whatever, before you order, you need to ask them, well, what specifically is the training of the expert who's going to help me interpret this? Because all three of us have extensive training in nutritional biochemistry. This work requires extensive training to understand the intricacies of these tests. So that would be my biggest message. I can certainly talk about the companies that I work with, but they're not direct to consumer. They're practitioners, practitioner. It is so important.
It's a huge message, and I won't name the company, but a lot of consumers, a lot of athletes come to me and say, oh, I had XXX test done. And therefore, I'm like, oh, but okay. So you had it done. Yes. Great. You had some testing done. You know, like your hair color, your eye color. Okay, great. You know, where you're from, that kind of thing. But I'm like, it's not giving you what you think it's going to give you. And in fact, like we were just talking about, I feel like a lot of those are more the monogenic model where it's just picking apart one or two genes instead of looking at the whole picture. So I think that's a good clarification for our listeners, and that, you know, we're not trying to make this, you know, we're not trying to make it kind of standoffish, but we want, you know, it's kind of like, you know, we can order so many tests these days as consumers compared to 10, 15 years ago. And it gets a little overwhelming, I'm sure, for consumers, even for me. But I think it's your message is, you know, let's work with a clinician, work with someone who specializes in this and not just generalizes in it.
It's true, because I'll often be contacted by people who've, you know, they've got complex health issues. They've worked with very, very good clinicians. But the genetic testing they come to me with, I just have to say, I'm sorry, I cannot interpret this because I cannot validate the gene or the utility of the information that's being presented. Therefore, if you want to work with me, I'm sorry, but you have to work with the testing. You have to work with a testing company, right? That I'm going to recommend.
Totally. Yeah. So I guess a good message, and I spread this too, and I know Dina does also, is listeners, before you introduce any type of testing into your life, talk to a credible source, credible clinician, registered dietitian, physician, whomever it is, and have that conversation first instead of just dropping thousands of dollars on these tests. And you don't know if they're actually going to be useful to work with those clinicians with, right? So that might be a good message on that one.
Yeah. And don't be afraid. I mean, you know, I am often interviewed by patients, you know, what do I know? Who do I know? What do I think? That is fine. I mean, I'll only give you 15 minutes, but I give you time. You know, if you're going to spend a good amount of money, then it is your, do yourself a favor and interview that individual and understand
Absolutely.
Your training. So important.
Yeah. Love it. Okay. So listeners, we've got our background set. Now we're going to get to the, really the bioactive parts of this conversation. Did you like how I threw that in there, man? I was gonna say meat and potatoes, but I was like, no, that's really not what we're talking about, right? Okay, so let's segue a little bit. And now, and really this is one of the main focuses of this specific episode is we want to talk about appetite, satiety, these quote unquote diets, the fat, like everything. But can we talk about, let's start with like appetite and satiety, like when we're talking about genomics, genetics, because I think that's a good beginning discussion into all these, some of these crazy things that we're seeing these days that athletes are doing, right? So where do we start with appetite, satiety, and genes?
Yeah, huge. And it's huge, right?
Yeah,
it is.
It's really the foundation of trying to understand not which foods and why, but it's answering the question, why am I always hungry? Or how do I know when to stop? Because we have to kind of get past that before we even get to metabolism and, you know, all the complex areas of fat and carbohydrates and macros and what have you. So what I see in my practice and, you know, working with these professional level DNA companies, we're working with very specific genes where we have the scientific literature to support what we're seeing, the what and the why. So what does that mean? It is very true that there are a subsection of many of us, and it could be our kids too, whose genes are sending scrambled messages that are altering our sense of hunger and satiety. And this isn't like the post-workout, you know, oh my God, I'm like really, really hungry. It's actually the opposite a lot of times, that exercise will reduce your hunger, right? And there's a reason for that. But what we're able to see through genetics is when certain genes line up, the hunger faucet is turned on. And the messages to your brain, like you're full, you're full, you're full, are turned off. And this is very, very real. So we see people, and this is the advantage of being in clinical practice too, is that I can literally, and you guys can too, we can see a slew of genes in a bucket, if you will, that prompt us to ask the question, are you up like in the refrigerator at 10 at night? Do you always feel hungry? And it's about a 90% yes, is what I'm seeing. So there's certain, so we talk about some of the genes we look at and the why. You want to talk about that? Yeah. So we're starting
absolutely.
With the genes.
Yeah.
So one of the key genes that's probably in most reports is called FTO, the FTO gene. And it has an awful name, which I'm not even going to name, but we call it FTO. This is the rabble riser. This is the kid in the neighbors like, you know, could you just go to bed, please? They're always out, you know, making a noise in the street. Like, wow, can the kid go to bed, please? So FTO is a real challenge of a gene, because what it does is it actually alters the signal to the ghrelin hormone. So ghrelin is your I'm hungry. It's like your stomach's growling, growl, ghrelin hormone, and it keeps it turned on. So the signal to your brain is eat, 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 eat. At the same time, it's so nasty, if you will, that it sends a signal to the leptin receptor, which has a gene. It's encoded by the LEPR gene, so the leper gene. So it sends a message to leptin to say, hey, you know, we're not full, you're not full, you're not full. So leptin turns off your hunger. It gives you the satiety signal. So you've already seen with one gene, it's starting to scramble the signals. And the form of that gene that does this is the A form. So we look at different forms of genes. So we look immediately, FTOAA is like, uh-oh, you know. And then you say, okay, well, that's just one gene. Here comes polygenic. So what? Well, what FTO does is sends a signal down through another gene called POMC. And this is funny, you guys. I was listening to a training in the UK probably a few months ago, and they said, oh, this is the Labrador gene. You're like, what? The Labrador gene? No, you know how Labradors are so cute, but you know, if you're not careful, they can put on weight pretty fast because they're always hungry, right? And so, you know, I'm in the Labrador lovers group, and it's hilarious all over the world. posting pictures of their cute little fat Labradors, and some are skinny, but a lot of them are like, they're just the most gorgeous dog, but they tend to carry weight, right? Mm-hmm. Or they can do. So they have this gene, the POMC gene, in a certain form is what Labradors have, and it's what helps to keep them eating, right? They're little, you know, they're always there, like counter surfing or whatever. So they will call it the counter surfing gene. So FTO, the rabble riser, talks to the Labrador gene, POMC, that relays a signal onto another gene, MC4R. MC4R is called the buffet gene. So what's going on here is you got a signal that's scrambling, that's saying, stop, no, you are still hungry. You're not full. Relays through this relay station down to the buffet, the gene says, keep on serving it up. Keep on bellying up to the plate. And it's very, very real. Then you add on another gene, the clock gene. So we all have it's incredible, right? We all learned this many years ago that the human body has a clock, has a master clock in the brain, and all your organs have clocks too. And so your body is synchronized. It's brilliant. And actually, when you look back at Chinese medicine, like we knew this probably hundreds of thousands of years ago, and us on the Western medicine, like, nah, but it's true. We have a clock gene. What we see when we put all these genes together and apply the body clock is if you have aberrations in your clock gene, then you are often going to be a night owl versus an early morning person. This is true to what we see in genetics. Then you add in, hey, I like to be up late at night, and you've got all these, you know, satiety cues upside down. Guess what? You're in the refrigerator, you know, eating late at night. And then what you do, you go to bed and then your insulin is out trying to handle all that you just ate.
Right.
And then you wake up later and you don't get your exercising, and it goes, it's a vicious cycle. And so there's a lot. So the take home from this is, there's a lot of information for genetics that help us understand if you're experiencing some weight loss resistance, why, and we know what to do about it. First of all, we have to set the stage to understand what you may be going through to be able to say, okay, now we've got that straight. Let's start to plan. How does that,
That's such a great picture that you're painting. Could you, in that scenario you were describing, if someone were experiencing those things and had the testing done and some of these genes identify as, you know, aligning with their experience and kind of the I think you say often like the layers being peeled back or peeled down. Could you give an example or some things that then are pursued, and maybe you have to put this in a specific context, but like, well, then what do we do if we
now
understand?
What do we do? And of course, we just looked at one bucket, right? So
one bucket is
understanding hunger cues. Then we're looking at the bigger picture of, okay, so how can we organize that? We don't just say, okay, you got the FTO-AA gene, guess what? Then you do need to pay attention to what you're eating and how much you're eating. Correlate that with exercise, right? Because we, you know, the two go together. Mm-hmm. But we know with some of these genes how we can turn them on and off. So let's just talk about that. So with the FTO-AA form of the gene, or if you have like, I forget what the other allele is, but if it's AA, or we saw a heterozygous, which means you have a slightly different form of the gene, we can actually titrate up the amount of protein in your diet. So this form of the gene, it's very useful, right? Will actually do better with, yes, a lower carbohydrate, but a higher protein diet. So we may be talking about 1.6 to 2 grams of protein per kilogram for women, and men can take more, which is really useful to know. So we're not talking keto, we're talking about changing the protein, because these genes will react to that. But if you have a different form of the gene, no, the higher protein, we would actually take you to a lower protein diet. But of course, that has to fit in. If you're an athlete, then of course, we have to manipulate that. We have to know where you're starting from to know where we can go to. Right. And so the other thing is, there's like being aware of your environment. What I do know, and it's very interesting, when we see the FTO and MC4 RNAs, another gene in that mix, and talking with other clinicians, is when you see that, there are certain environments for some people that are like, don't put yourself in that environment and try and do time-restricted eating or count calories, because psychologically you can't. It's a really bad idea to go to Vegas, you know? I'm going to control myself. Just don't go to the buffet. Or if you do, just know it's over, because it's too psychologically difficult for some people who have these set of genes that are all turned on to say, okay, just go to an overflowing food environment, you'll be just fine. Just hold back. It's not fair, because your genes are going to override potentially your ability as a human being to say no. So it's kind of useful to see that and to be able to validate how somebody feels and to empower them to know you're not imagining things. This is very true for you. Therefore, this is what we're going to do. Organizing things like make sure your meals, you know, they are satiety inducing versus, you know, fantasy fulfilling, you know, or organizing your day, et cetera, et cetera. So,
You hit on something. I'm going to try to pose a question here, but I just want to confirm this, because I was going to ask this exact question that you just hit. Because a lot of our listeners, a lot of athletes are like, let's just package weight loss, right? Or weight loss resistance, or whatever we want to call it, right? Well, so athletes are having a problem losing weight or body composition or changing their body comp. And they're like, oh, it's just me. I don't have the willpower. I don't have the motivation. And, you know, that psychological piece we always think about. You know, and when I work with athletes, I'm like, no, you do have it. It's there, but we're likely working against some things that we don't know about yet, because maybe we don't have the genomic testing yet, right? Mm-hmm. But I just want to kind of throw out there, and I'm trying to loop in a question here, but it's not always I don't have willpower and that's why I'm not succeeding. It is literally because there are inherent messages that are either being turned on or off.
Yes.
Through your genes, possibly through food, that are contributing to it. It's not the only reason, obviously, because psychology is part of it, right? But this is a huge hurdle. And that's what I've been hearing from you, is the genes are a huge hurdle in this possible weight loss, you know, puzzle, if you will.
Yes.
Is that correct to say?
It is. And I think what I love about the work is it validates where we're going to start from. You know, it says to the person in front of you, you are not imagining this. This is what's happening with Eugene's. Okay, now we've got that. Here's what we're going to do about it. But let's at least get the elephant out of the room and validate how someone's feeling. And no, it's not about willpower. You've got a few things. And yeah, we can manipulate that. So another one in this whole picture is like a dopamine gene, like DRD2. Mm. That is like an ultra, if you know how dopamine works, it's risk reward. Imagine having a gene in the appetite satiety bucket that's like, yeah, you know, you got to go, you know, I'm, and it's a dysregulated gene. Therefore, I'm going to use food to get a high, right? And that's amazing because that's what some people are doing. It's like, okay, and it's not stress related. It's like, I'm going to feel better if I have that Starbucks, whatever. And they do, you know, because the gene's saying, feed me, feed me, feed me, feed me, feed me. So this is the brilliance of genetics, is it looks at you and says, I can see through genetics where you're coming from. That's very powerful.
Yeah, I can speak to what you just said, because I've worked with a few athletes that I vividly remember who have that same exact reaction. Like that is, it's the reward of the food. And unfortunately with them, I couldn't encourage them to do any testing. So we couldn't really do the deep dive. But what about, you know, we all encounter this and it's just, I'm kind of growing a little tired of it. And it seems to be ebbing and flowing, but you know, athletes coming to us and saying, oh, I'm going to do keto. I'm going to do LCHF. I'm going to stick with high carb, low fat. And, but they don't know why. Or usually the reason is because of weight loss for the most part, if we're talking like keto or LCHF. But I mean, what do you say to someone who just comes to you and say, Amanda, I'm going to go keto, I'm going to go LCHF with no other reasoning other than I'm going to try to lose weight? Like, what is your message?
So, you know, it's really interesting that I rarely have anyone come to me and say, I'm going to do keto.
Okay. You're lucky.
You know, like in the athletic community, I could see.
Yeah.
Usually in my experience, I'm going to answer your question. People have dabbled and tried a lot of different things, you know, and they say, oh my gosh, my body's broken. So I end up with, you know, pretty complex individuals, and weight often is the last thing. It's like, yeah, that's the elephant in the room. But how I got here is really the journey that we want to uncover. So what I see, to answer your question, is people, if we're talking about weight or trying to lose weight or weight loss resistance, people oftentimes have done intermittent fasting or TRE and keto and been really, really successful, and they've no idea why. Then they just jump off a bit. And they're like right back where they started. They got bored with it or fed up with it, or they, you know, whatever, or we're still, their triglycerides and, you know, cholesterol went through the roof and they don't know why. Yes. So I am able to look at genes. We know enough now in genetics to know who is a good candidate to manipulate to keto. And we have to describe, you know, what do we mean by keto? It's huge, right? It's huge parameters in what we're looking at, and who can't and who won't. And it's not about, well, if you have Alzheimer's or diabetes, we're not, and there's definitely some parameters, right, that we're looking at, but it's not about a diagnosis. It's literally looking at the forms of your genes that line up. So we're talking polygenic, that say, if they're all lined up in this form, we can probably push you over to keto, monitor it, and you'll achieve your goals. That's what's important, because what's happening, as you're seeing, is you've got a bunch of people who are just guessing. And it's like, ooh, this really worked for me, but it didn't work for somebody else. Or yeah, I lost a bunch of weight, but my doctor said, forget it. You can't do that, because now your cholesterol's through the roof, right?
Totally.
Tests don't guess. So genetics tells us where you can start. And then lab testing is the validation that we're on the right track, right? And so you can save a whole lot of time. And much probably with genetics, at least we're informed how those genes work, to know what's going to happen in your cells, which we can talk about if you want. But I think that's been very, very powerful for me, you know, to really know that I can push someone in a certain direction, regardless of what their diagnosis is or what have you. And say, I think we're safe. We're going to watch and monitor, but I think you're fine. Versus somebody, as I'm saying, whose genes are, they do not align, and you're going to be in trouble. You may lose weight, but you're going to be on a statin.
Yeah.
Right.
I, Literally, I want to jump out of my computer right now and hug you. Honestly, so let me share a quick story before we segue. And listeners, you need to listen to this, because if you did not hear what Amanda just said, you need to stop, rewind, just play that last, 60 second clip, because here's the reason. Because and I know Dina does this too, but I get a little crazy in my N of one experiments. Cause as a sport dietitian, I like to try things that, I think my athletes will do. And I'm like, okay, so at least I can speak to it, right? So I've done so many different things and call it different strategies. But when keto kind of came back years ago, I was like, okay, I'll try this, see how my body responds. Cause everyone was doing it, not that I needed to be the cool kid on the block. I just needed to be knowledgeable. And so I was pretty close to keto. I wasn't full on keto, which I define as less than 20 grams of carbs a day, but I was right around 30 to 40 grams. Tiny. Yeah. Small. Oh. Right. But here's the thing. This is what was interesting to me. So I was very restricted with my carbohydrates, ate a lot of fat, protein stayed the same, which a lot of people have done or are doing with keto. And what I noticed was pretty immediately, of course, I'm going to be more satiated. I felt, fuller longer. I felt great. Body composition was changing. I was losing body fat. My body weight wasn't changing too much. It dropped a few pounds from water weight, but I was like, wow, this is interesting, right? And I always do a lot of testing on myself in terms of blood work and biomarkers and stuff. And what I noticed after, I believe I did that for 3 or 4 months, and then I did another blood work test. Yeah, it was hard, by the way, just FYI. Training suffered a little bit too. But what I noticed was, to your point, and this is the only reason I'm sharing this story, because it's so individual. And listeners, you need to have the testing done, because I found, in relation to what you were saying with cholesterol, blood lipid numbers, my ApoB shot through the roof. And so alarming. Like, cholesterol, I don't give it as much clout to. I look at the other particles and what the things we're talking about. But ApoB literally went sky high, and it freaked me out. It really did, right? And I've been monitoring that for years, highest it's ever been. And so, I guess the message here, listeners, and for everyone, is even though I was having success, I lost body fat. I was feeling great for the most part. I mean, cognitively, it was great. Inside, it was like a fire, right? Mm-hmm. And if that continued, I mean, who knows what would have happened if I didn't do testing or if I didn't catch it. But it proves this N of one, at least, proves that one quote unquote diet is not right for every single person, that we are needing to associate the genes that we have and the different SNPs or the spelling errors that we have on these genes. So I just wanted to kind of add in that story, mm-hmm. because that was, it's so powerful. Like, the work you've done is so powerful, and it's actually, redirected a lot of what I do in my practice and even for my personal health journey. So thank you. But also, listeners, listen to that again, because Amanda literally speaks a lot of the truth here, all the truth, but this is so important to remember.
It is. Yes. Period.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wondered, Amanda, I was just thinking, some things that you're saying is, it's kind of like looking at how the gene picture can also guide not just the food choices or maybe a dietary pattern, but what you were mentioning earlier, like environmental, how we structure our environment and or modify behaviors, some of those other things that complete the lifestyle picture, or maybe even our exercise programming. Then I was also thinking, when you were mentioning time-restricted eating and keto, and maybe kind of thinking of the fasting world, some of the guidelines here that are coming out that are gender-based for athletes, like for female athletes, maybe in perimenopause, there's some messages out there like keto is not for any female athlete in perimenopause. And it's a very black and white statement. And I don't think those messages consider the gene picture. So do you have thoughts on that? And maybe how the gene testing can come into that, and then our own individual experience, what we're looking for or living as a health story.
Yeah. And it's interesting. So, Bob and I worked on a program with Bobby Klein and Joe Veltman a number of years ago. And I remember Joe was a real pioneer. He was like a mentor to both of us, really brilliant. Mm-hmm. PhD, and taught us a lot in genomics. And he told us something many years ago, which has stuck with me. It's like, you know what? We look at a lot of scientific literature, but if we're now reading research that doesn't include genetics, then we're missing this huge part. Yeah. So when I, which, you know, okay, so that's the space we're in, all of us, you know, it's cutting edge in our field. But when you hear black and white messages like that, I just disregard them because I'm like, well, what are you basing that on? Yeah. If you're not looking through the lens of the individual, then it's just guesswork. It's nice. Okay, it's epidemiologically and scientifically informed, but we work on an N of one. There's no one individual that has the same genes. So how can we apply something as huge as perimenopause and, hey, keto's not going to work for you? Baloney. You know, that's just not true. Nice. And it depends on the individual's goals. And when you say environmentally, I keep thinking, you know, of how many people we now see, women who have PCOS, right? So, and you know, insulin resistance and weight, of course, weight loss resistance comes with that. They are really suffering and there's infertility. And you look at that and genetically, we can certainly see why they're heading that, that direction. You know, there's buckets and buckets of genes, but you know, why is this happening? And that goes back to environmental, that, you know, what are they eating? What are our genes exposed to, you know, in the last 30 years that is resulting in these exponential levels of things like PCOS or cancer or what have you. And that's where genetics is really useful. And that's where understanding why these people are interacting with their environment and what we need to do. And I think before we started talking, I said, you know, so much of what's going on when we're looking at weight loss resistance, people struggling with weight, it's actually got nothing to do with your food. It has to do with your personal care products and what you're exposed to and, you know, the new furniture in your house and this bombardment of our genes with our environment. And until we clear that up and clean that up, doesn't matter whether you're on keto or, you know, low carbohydrate, high protein or whatever, you know, we're missing the elephant in the room, which is we have to clean up that, which is just stymieing communication to your genes. So,
yes. Thank you for that. I also just along the female specific train of thought here going on in my noggin. I was just wondering with menopause and appetite changes that are often experienced or body weight, body composition changes, is this more like the epigenetic, some things happening there, or do we tie in, gosh, I don't even know how to construct the question very well, but just some of answering some of those questions, because it's so individual, the menopause experience and transition. So do you have anything to add to that piece for the those kind of listeners that are out there?
Yeah, of which there are many, right? And, you know, yeah. I have to say one of the greatest interviews you two did was with Dr. Stacy Sims, you know, who's just so brilliant in this space. I'm not sure I can even step in and be as knowledgeable as her. But I think with menopause, like it is so individual again for someone. So when I see women who are struggling going, and of course, you know, we're talking about women, we forget about men going through andropause. I mean, these you guys get left out and we, you know, we all go through midlife differently. But for women, what I see happening is, yeah, there's an environmental piece. Our hormones are changing. And depending on how your hormone detoxification genes present, plus genes are impacting dopamine and serotonin. I'm looking at that big picture to say, yes, if you don't detoxify estrogen well, or if you have very high levels of testosterone, which are going to convert to estrogen, you're going to potentially be in estrogen dominance, which is further accentuated by the environment, right? So then we have women pinging like, oh my God, high, low, high, low, high, low. And then you have potentially aberrations with dopamine, which make it even worse, you know, very high levels of dopamine, which are existing alongside whatever's going on hormonally, can have people being an anxious wreck, not sleeping, right? And depending on what's going on with serotonin and we and those appetite genes, it all plays into I feel out of control. Yeah. So it's not just I'm going through menopause. It is how your genes, the whole picture of your genes being considered with how you feel. And that's really where genetics is brilliant, because, and that's, you know, a lot of my work is in the midlife space.
Yeah.
So that in when I'm talking with women, is it's once again validating, oh, I can see why you've been on the journey you have. I think through my your genes, I can see exactly how you're feeling. Let's do this, you know? And so we're not just guessing, like, here, take licorice or ashwagandha, or
right,
you're still here, take dim, and nobody's, and somebody doesn't have any estrogen. It's like,
yeah,
we'll do this. You know, this is not a good thing. So genetics lends a lot of sanity and storytelling and explanations to why, and gives us a care plan.
So. Absolutely.
That was beautiful. Thank you.
Awesome. Yeah. Amanda, you know, I was talking a lot about testing, and we have mentioned it quite a bit. How, just for listeners again, who maybe haven't caught our first episode with you, how often do people need to have their genomics tested?
Once.
Once. Isn't Once. That beautiful? And why? One tell and the done. Listeners why. Why is that?
Because you're born with these genes. What changes the genes is the environment, right? So what you're born with is who you are, right? They don't change. The environment is what changes, and that's epigenetics, right? And that's maybe a conversation for another day. But
right.
You, to me, every single individual, maybe over the age of 7, or maybe we can get to 21 if you want, maybe, or 12, everyone should, it should be the first piece in your medical chart, should be your genetics, right? Because that explains who you are and the why. And yes. whether we're looking at cardiovascular issues or neurological issues, we've got a frame of reference. It's not predictive or diagnostic, but it's what we come back to understand the why of why somebody may be on a certain journey. And it's a reminder to all of us, right? So you only need genetic testing once, or genomics is where we're working. The other testing, the laboratory testing, that is ongoing, right? As you shift, as life changes, we may do repeat testing, or we may change the type of testing. That's what changes, but your genetics, they don't.
Which is the beauty, and it's kind of music to a lot of people's ears, because I think a lot of people say, oh, I can't afford that. It's too much. And it's like, well, it's only once. Like literally you spend a few $100 and it's only once, and you get so much great information. And to your point, like, you do need to follow up with other tests, other biomarker, other blood work tests throughout your lifespan, of course. Mm-hmm. But that's why I think it's so easy to talk about genomic testing, because it literally is a one and done test.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is. One and you're done. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So our listeners want to know this, and I know this because I get all these questions all the time. How can people start their genomic journey in their kitchen? What are some easy, simple, like low-hanging fruits and vegetables? You see how I squeezed that one in?
And herbs.
And herbs and spices. Like, how can they start? Because a lot of times people are like, oh my gosh, this is so much. I can't handle all this. This is a life change. What do you say to that? Like, where can people start with this in their own kitchen?
So, the message hasn't changed since the beginning since we were born, right?
Yeah.
Eat your fruits and vegetables, or eat your vegetables and fruit. I'm going to put vegetables in front of fruit.
Yeah.
And as you heard Dina say, put herbs and spices in your kitchen. So what you're hearing us say is, like, we're not like, we can go deep, deep, deep into, okay, which and why and how. But these foods are what talk to your genes. Okay, they will talk to your genes first. The most powerful information food is going to be in vegetables, herbs and spices, if you want to know that. And oh, by the way, everyone, olive oil is probably the most potent medicine that is derived from food that you can use. Period.
And I just stop you because I'm Italian. I know you know that, Amanda. But
yes.
And I know you love your olive oil. When I visited you, I was like, oh my gosh, this olive oil. Ooh. Can you just rabbit hole, but a short rabbit hole, not too deep. Can you speak on the whole olive oil thing? Because you go in the store and you're like, oh, that's the blank, blank brand, the private label, whatever. They cost $6 for 32 ounces or whatever. Like, can you just really quickly give our listeners an idea of what they should be looking for in olive oil? Or maybe not looking for.
Yeah, it should be a single variety from Puglia.
Yeah.
No, the olive oil has become extremely distorted, I have to say, and it's a very difficult topic to navigate. But yeah, definitely what I would say in terms of olive oil, if you're going to buy it, what we don't often have in the US is a timestamp. But if you're ever able to turn over or look on the bottle or the can or whatever, we'll talk about the delivery system in a moment, see if there's a timestamp or a date stamp. That is really important. Olive oil becomes rancid. That's number one. Number two, you will buy it always in a tin or can or a really dark bottle that has not been exposed to light because it will oxidize. Okay. That's number one. Number two is when you open it and you smell it, it should smell like olive oil. It should smell fruity. If it smells like paint thinner, return it to the store. It's oxidized. So yeah. Number three, and I'm going to be shamelessly say this, to me, the best olive oil in the world actually is produced by a company in Greece. I'm going to tell you who they are and why, but this doesn't undermine beautiful Italian, you know, olive oils or Greek or Spain or California if it comes to that. But there's a wonderful company called Milestone. So you can just Google for Milestone olive oil. Or you can look under the URL of Dreams and Knowledge. And maybe what I can do is from the company, I don't make money from them. I just know them so well, is maybe they'll send over a discount coupon we can send out to your list.
We'd love that. Yeah.
What they have done is they have harvested olive oil from old, from ancient olives. So the ancient olives are the size of capers. They're not big. They're tiny. I've actually been to their area in the Peloponnese in Greece. And so they are producing olive oil that's nutrigenomic. It has probably the highest phenolic content in the world. And when we say, which is incredible. So when you taste this olive oil, it kicks the back of your throat. They're now formulating it with things like curcumin, with algae, with pomegranate. It's brilliant. And we're using this as medicine. This is our supplement, right? Because we all know like how this is working. So olive oil has probably some of the most diverse amount of polyphenols in the world too. It depends where it's coming from. But we're actually able to look at this in databases and see the levels of these polyphenols. Remember, we started the conversation with polyphenols turn genes on and off. So, so that is why olive oil is so, so important. Particularly to those of us who live in the Western world, you know, if you live in the Asias, not so much, you know, although it's funny, this company is now exporting to Singapore, which is interesting. So it's catching on, but olive oil is your best medicine. So know that what I just talked about, when you taste these finishing oils, these are nutrigenomic, almost pharmaceutical oils, they're brilliant. They are not for cooking with. You can certainly put them in your smoothies, your sprinkle on your salad, whatever. That is the best supplement you can take, in my informed opinion.
Amazing. I'm drooling.
I feel like we could have just had the episode for that little 2 minutes and it would be the best episode ever, right? Amanda, can people in the United States, and I know we have listeners around the world, so pardon me, but can people in the United States purchase this? Like, do they?
Yes, you can. Okay. And I'll just shoot you a note afterwards. Absolutely.
Yeah, we'll put it in the show notes, listeners. Yeah, for sure.
Brilliant. It's brilliant what they're doing. So
amazing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Amanda, I think you should do a TED Talk. Can we get you on a TED
for
Talk?
Sure.
It would be incredible. We need an Amanda Archibald TED Talk. Before we move to the final segment of our discussion with you, can you highlight, if you can, any current projects you're working on? I know, and we'll be sure to put link to your Instagram, your website, your book resources, and the clinician, all the services that you have. But can you share what some current projects are?
Oh my gosh, current project. Yeah. So this is more on the clinical side of the house. I am going to be releasing a hub. It's actually finally a membership hub for clinicians around genomics, but it has, so you two know my work for many years. It has components that are associated with my roadmap. So we do the interpretive maps. We have social media, so infographics that we use clinically for social media, really important. But I think importantly, this sort of interesting for all of us is it's going to be driven around genomics plus culinary. So it's producing a pub, a cub, a club, a hub in partnership with my chef, a partner in the UK, Kate. We're both clinicians. We both work in culinary. So it's a translational space. So we're really excited. So it's almost like the best of me, but in a space where we meet as professionals, you know, clinical professionals in the space. So that's on our side. For the public, I've worked with a strategist for a number of years. We are looking at coming out with a second version of my book.
All right. Awesome. I've been waiting for that.
I know. Okay. We'll just put a pin in that. We'll see. You know what it's like, right? Both of you guys. But so, you know, that the heart of the Genomic Kitchen is MISE, the MISE. This is an organization of foods that speak to our genes. So what we're thinking of doing is MISE a la carte. So the a la carte is where we pull in additional ingredients based on what we're trying to target, like cardiovascular health or neurological, cognitive, energy, mitochondria. So those are kind of my two major projects that I'm remembering right now.
Awesome.
Those are on top of your list.
I can't
wait. Yeah, perfect. Well, Amanda, I want to get to the high five questions because we have some fun ones for you. So these are just, as you remember, probably these are just for our listeners to kind of get to know you a little bit on the side. So they're just fun and kind of rapid fire, if you will. So are you ready for these? You ready?
Yeah,
for the
this
first
is
one?
Always yikes.
It no, is, right?
Don't
it
tell
is.
Me.
So we've been talking about food and, you know, veggies and fruits and polyphenols and phytochemicals and all that great, great, great stuff. We want to know what your favorite indulgence food or meal is. Like, do you have a go-to indulgence, comfort, whatever food or meal?
Oh, you know, because I grew up overseas, so it's completely different for me.
Yeah.
So an indulgence food. I can tell you an indulgence drink.
Okay.
Yeah, that works.
So if I'm going to indulge, I mean, I love Negronis, you know, from Italy. Oh. You would love that, right? And Negronis, it's part of Italian life. So
yeah,
indulgent food. I'm not a dessert person. So honestly, you know, growing up in England, I love fish and chips. I mean, I just think
they're great. I had the feeling you would say that. Yeah.
Fish and chips. Amazing. I love it. Yeah. Amanda, what is a hobby of yours that not many people may know about?
Knitting. I knit.
Oh.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I don't know if I knew that, but okay, good. Yeah. Okay. Number three, this might be a little tougher, but a garden or farmer's market for your vegetables, if you had a choice or if you do.
Ooh, well, you know Colorado, both of you. So I live in the high desert. And this side of Colorado is a high desert. It's really desert. We all live in a high desert. So here I actually prefer the farmer's market because it's more difficult to grow here. It just is. It's a whole different set of parameters. Now, I do have herbs growing here, but I enjoy the farmer's market because of the talent it takes to grow when you have heat and altitude. So yeah.
good. Okay. Number four, Amanda, this may be a little more humorous, but imagine that you are stranded on a deserted island and you're going to be rescued. So you don't need, you know, to worry about that piece, but you don't know when you're going to be rescued and you can have three things with you. What would those three things be?
Well, you know, one thing or two things, two, three, I don't want to have is any like digital communication, which is really interesting, right? I'm like, oh my God, I'm on a desert island. Three things I'd want to have. I would probably want to have my knitting. I'm not kidding. So it's like, I want to have something to do.
Yeah.
I want to have an avocado.
Nice.
Oh, and yeah, and probably something to read, you know, I know that's just odd. And what would I would want to read? I'm not sure. Yeah, I know. Thanks a lot, guys.
I know that one was a little challenging.
I thought you were going to say olive oil, but you got it close.
I want to have a kind of, you know, something that'll fuel you and something to keep you occupied, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Maybe my yoga mat, you know, that would be, you don't need that on the desert island because you just use the beach.
Yeah. you could take like a pomegranate or two, and you could spend days trying to peel those things by hand.
Yeah, that's so a good idea.
That would entertain you. Okay, last question we have for you. Based on our conversation today, what is one piece of advice, and only one, that you would give to all athletes?
Test, don't guess.
Oh, I had a feeling you would say that too.
It's so honestly important, isn't I mean it? If you want to up your game and whatever your goal is, don't guess, you know. Yeah. You know, if you're serious, get your baseline, because otherwise you're messing around, you're wasting time, valuable time, and possibly valuable. So test, don't guess, please.
Oh, amazing.
Love that. Again, thank I just you. Want to jump out and hug you again.
I know. Many virtual hugs coming your way, Amanda. Hopefully not the kind that like take the breath out of you, but gentle, continual hugs. Thank you so much. You are such a wealth of information. Everyone go to genomickitchen.com or Genomic Kitchen on Instagram. We'll put more links in the show notes, but we can't thank you enough, Amanda. I mean, obviously this, we could talk for 20 different episodes on, or 300 on this field, but thank you for sharing your wisdom and knowledge with us. We greatly appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It's always fun to be with my Colorado pals. So
that's right. That's right. Awesome. Thank you so much. And listeners, tune in to the next episode, and hopefully we'll have Amanda on in another, well, hopefully not more than a year, because I'm hoping for your second edition of the book coming out soon, which we can chat about then. But please stay tuned to our next episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on the next one. Well, we hope you enjoyed episode 95, where we sat down and chatted with Amanda Archibald regarding genomics, nutrition, and really everything associated with that. She is such a great, great person. So hope you learned a lot from that. Now, stay tuned for next episode next week when we talk to our good friend Joel Totoro. He is a registered dietitian and the director of nutrition and sports science over at Thorn. Now, we're going to discuss and dissect the supplement industry and get all into supplements, types of supplements, what should you be taking, what should you not be taking, and why. So that episode is going to be a phenomenal one. Do not miss that. If you do have any sport nutrition related questions, could be about genomics, could be about supplements, could be about anything, head on over to our website, insidesportsnutrition.com. There's a contact us link, or additionally, you can just shoot us an email, hello@insidesportsnutrition.com. We love getting your questions, and we love answering your questions on the air. So please head on over. And while you're at our website, be sure to check out all of our show notes of all of our episodes, right? So catch up, binge listen to some of our episodes. We would actually love that, and love your support also. If you could go over to your favorite podcast platform of choice where you listen to podcasts, and please submit a review for us. Give us a 5-star rating, give us a review. It just really helps grow our podcast and share it with other people that you know, family, friends, training partners, doesn't matter, right? We would love you helping us support our podcast by just reviewing and giving us a 5-star rating. If you would like more information about what Dina and I do in our respective businesses, head on over to my website, energyperformance.com. That's energyperformance.com. And check out Dina's website, nutritionmechanic.com. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and the guest involved, and do not represent a replacement for medical consultation with your doctor. The information and opinions provided here are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease or medical condition. This podcast is for information, education, and entertainment purposes only.